Okay, next case for argument is Dexter Axle Company versus Machinists. Mr. Neighbors?
Yes, Your Honor. We've not actually met. I
thought that might be appropriate. Good morning, Your Honors, and Mr. Hamilton. May it please the Court, as you know from the record, I am John Neighbors. I'm an attorney from Baker & Daniels in Indianapolis, and I represent Dexter Axle. I think you're aware that this is an action to vacate an arbitrator's decision. I find it interesting that this court's cornerstone decision dealing with vacating an arbitrator's decision, that two of the judges here today were on that panel 20 years ago in the Ethel Corporation decision in 1985. We're not going to take issue with the standard, of course. We recognize that we have a heavy burden to demonstrate to this court that the arbitrator's decision should be vacated. Doesn't matter that his decision we think is incorrect or wrong, or even that he misread the collective bargaining agreement. What matters is whether he exceeded the authority that was granted to him by that collective bargaining agreement. And we'll demonstrate to you, and we believe our brief demonstrates, that he in fact did exceed that authority. Quickly, to put this case in context, the company and the union had agreed to a base rate of pay for their workers under the collective bargaining agreement, and then they had agreed to a separate incentive pay supplement. There was a separate attachment to the collective bargaining agreement, very intentionally dealt with incentive pay in a completely separate manner. The company went about, during the life of the agreement, changing the incentive rates as they had the right to do. The employees and eventually the union complained about that change, and that complaint worked its way through the process of the separate incentive pay system as a separate attachment to the collective bargaining agreement. The arbitrator found that the companies, having changed the rate, they did so improperly. The company does not challenge that decision at all. But by awarding back pay, the arbitrator relied on a provision in the collective bargaining agreement in the main body of the document to award back pay, and by doing so ignored the limitations that were imposed upon him by the separate document that was an attachment to the collective bargaining agreement. In other words, he confused the two provisions.
What is all this underlining in the arbitrator's opinions? Is that his underlining or your underlining?
It's his underlining.
His underlining?
And as you'll note, he, in fact, in his final award, underlines and notes the limitations on his authority, but then inexplicably resorts to another provision in the main body of the collective bargaining agreement to award back pay.
Our sections 11 and 12 of the supplement specifically refer to the articles of the collective bargaining agreement, and you're emphasizing the exclusionary language in section 12, I guess, and they're... The arbitrator's relying on this reference, so you know who's right and who's wrong. Is it just a matter of a?
It doesn't matter that he was wrong. It wouldn't matter if he were wrong in what he did. What would matter is did he exceed his authority? And I understand what you're saying, and it's the crux of the appellee's
argument.
What's
the difference between his being mistaken and his looking at the wrong provision in the contract? Right? You said it wouldn't be he wouldn't have exceeded his authority if he'd misread the contract.
Yes.
Now you just said he misread it because he based his decision on an inapplicable provision.
I did say that.
That's
but
the same thing. That's
I did say that. I did say that, Your Honor, except you then before I finished went to your point. What I would have said at that point was, and by going to the wrong section of the contract, he then ignored the expressed limitation of Section 12 of the separate attachment.
He made a mistake, but he wasn't going outside the contract. He was he was fumbling around inside the contract. As long as he stays inside the contract,
actually,
he can do what he wants.
No, he can't do
yes,
what he
can.
Wants. No, he
He's
can't.
Inside the contract.
I disagree.
He's not bringing in his personal ideas of industrial justice or what have you. That's the bad thing. He didn't do that.
I understand that. But what he did do was he ignored an express limitation on him.
He didn't ignore it. He looked around. He found something else.
He did find something else, but he ignored.
This is utterly routine arbitration stuff. I don't know why you've brought this case. I don't get it.
Well, I respectfully disagree that this is utterly routine.
This is utterly routine. He probably was correct. I mean, I think his analysis is quite reasonable. But
well,
the notion that he went outside and somehow he has his own ideas, he doesn't have his own ideas. This is highly technical stuff. There's no indication that he's overriding the contract because he's driven by some personal view of what is justice in these...
Your Honor, with all due respect, then, I will ask you to tell me, and I don't mean to be flippant here, but given the position you've taken, I think Mr. Hamilton could safely remain in his seat, but I would ask you to tell me, then what does the sentence mean in the contract, his authority shall be limited to reviewing whether the standard is proper? If you accept the argument that he went somewhere else, he renders that sentence meaningless.
He acknowledged that, and he went on and says, all I can do is consider whether it's proper. That's what he said.
But the contract has to be read as an entire document, and it's been rendered meaningless.
You see, this is where you don't understand the line. When you say that the document, the contract has to be read as an entire document, that is true when the issue is, did he misconstrue the agreement? That's the error question. That's not the usurpation question. The only time we set aside an arbitration is if he went outside the contract. Not if he misunderstood, but he threw it away. He was looking at other things.
I wouldn't
overrode it. There's no hint of that in his two opinions.
You're the judge, and the law will be what it is. But I would tell you, my interpretation of the law is, he could be with inside the contract and ignore an express provision. For example, let's assume Section 12 said, and back pay shall...
Look,
if I could finish, Your Honor,
no,
please,
you
respectfully.
Can't finish because it's extremely common in interpreting contracts to disregard express provisions. There are canons of construction about that. If a literal interpretation would be nonsense, would make the contract hopelessly one-sided, would be, in short, unreasonable, it can be ignored or it can be reinterpreted in a non-literal way. All your points are just about different ways in which a contract can be misinterpreted.
I have to respect your opinion, but I again disagree. And my point would be, let's assume the contract said back pay shall not be a remedy for an incentive pay grievance. If the contract had said that and he had gone to 8.2 and ignored Section 12, he would have been within the contract, but it clearly would be something that this court should vacate.
No,
and that's exactly what he's done.
Suppose he said the contract says back pay shall not be a remedy, but if you look at it in context, you realize this is focused on a particular issue, and there are other situations within the scope of the contract where I don't think this particular provision was intended to apply. So I'm adopting a non-literal interpretation of the contract. That could be right or wrong, but that is not a ground. The fact that you have refused to read a particular sentence in a contract literally is not a ground for setting aside an arbitration award.
You and I disagree with that because I think if you exceed your authority, and this is an authority section.
Do you think all contracts have to be interpreted literally?
I think all contracts, when they're clear and unambiguous, must be interpreted as they are written, as they're written. And when they're expressed, their expression needs to be enforced.
That isn't correct. You go to any contract treatise, and it'll say that, the presumption is that you interpret a contract in accordance with its literal language, but there are many ways in which that presumption can be rebutted, such as, it's unreasonable, it's not what they intended, there are other provisions which are tugging in different direction. So you're not even stating contract interpretation law correctly, let alone law of upsetting arbitration awards.
Well, I'll not attempt to compete with you in knowledge of contract interpretation. I have expressed my opinion. I think that this arbitrator exceeded his authority in ways that ignore the terms of the collective bargaining agreement, and I would tell you that all he did was give lip service. If you think he did it, then I'll tell you it's mere lip service, and it's an outlandish decision, and by this court's precedent, this court can say can correct an outlandish decision, even if he arguably has exercised some verbiage here in a lip service way within the four corners of the document. You still have the authority to vacate the arbitrator's decision.
And I want to know what your best case is from this circuit that is close to this case factually that calls this behavior activity outside the contract.
Probably the Polk Brothers decision.
But that case is not like this one in terms of the provisions that he looked at.
There is
trying to, because that's where I think you have problems, because I don't think you have a case.
Well, in the Polk Brothers decision, he awarded back pay.
Right.
He awarded back pay, and the contract had expired. And he didn't have any authority to award back pay. That's as close as I can't do anything about the fact that you have a limited number of cases that have come into this area and that there isn't one that's exactly on point.
Well, I understand, but that case is distinguishable from what
all the cases
here
are distinguishable in one factual way or another. But I think this court, and I think good sense of the judges in this courtroom, understand that you can give lip service to a contract, but if you ignore the authority given to you in a section that's called authority of an arbitrator and is dealing expressly with your authority, and you take liberties that are in ways that violate that authority, I disagree with Judge Posner, and I think you have the right and should, in fact, vacate the arbitrator's decision.
I'd like to ask a question about this inconsistency point, which is the other point that's raised here. By an inconsistency, do you mean that the earnings opportunity in one job will be greater or less than in the job you're talking about? Is that,
no.
Is that the inconsistency?
No, the inconsistency
point.
I mean,
most of these labor contracts provide that you're going to provide an incentive opportunity of 25% or something like that. I don't know if that's in this contract or not.
It actually is a sort of a barometer step.
When you talk about inconsistency, do you mean this job will give you 35% probably, and this job will only give you 15%, or are we talking about the methods that are used to set the standard?
The former, not the latter, although the latter ends up being a result of the former, which is why your question is appropriate. I would tell you from our perspective, particularly in light of this argument, the inconsistency argument is certainly very secondary to the fundamental issue of the arbitrator's authority, which he ignored his limitations and therefore subjected himself to having his decision vacated.
I think I understand that too. All right, go ahead.
Okay.
Thank you for your time, Your Honor.
Mr. Hamilton?
May it please the Court, John Hamilton from South Bend, representing the union in this case. I have a few comments, but I think what I will do is ask the Court if it has any questions. I would submit on the briefs.
My only question was about the inconsistency point. I think you heard that discussion. Do you have anything to add to the discussion?
Is the Court referring to the second argument?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, I believe what they were saying was that the arbitrator's award resulted in then the methods of determining incentive pay had become inconsistent with the part of the incentive pay program that the arbitrator did not find problematic. Our contention as to that is that it depends upon a packing of the record after the arbitration occurred. If you take a look at the arbitration documents themselves, the arbitrator Cox's interim award, his final award, and above all his communication with these folks after the award, and that is the November 20th.
Yeah, I think I understand that point. That's in the brief, too. But I was just trying to get a little better understanding of what an inconsistency was.
Well, I think that's where it's supposed to be, but you can't tell. You can't tell from the documentation, as many times you can't tell in an arbitration at all, given this one, for example. I'll tell the court, frankly, I didn't understand what this guy was saying. He's a time motion study expert, and I did not understand, had a clue as to all of his percentages. But that's the whole function of arbitration, to resolve these kinds of very specific job-related issues. And this arbitrator did a very good job. Consciously said throughout his materials that he's not able to go beyond the contract. He was doing a sincere job in good faith. It's demonstrable on its face, and for that reason I will submit on the brief unless the court has questions.
I just have one question. Isn't there a difference between an arbitrator misinterpreting a substantive provision of a contract and then misinterpreting the provision that confers upon him authority? Do you think there's a difference?
I think there can be a difference, but let me respond then to that question. The company is relying upon this doctrine of expressio unius est exclusio et alterius. And that, as I recall it, is a doctrine that is supposed to remove ambiguity where ambiguity exists. We submit that there is no ambiguity here when you see the interrelationship of section, I think it's 11 or 12 of the supplemental incentive pay plan, as it refers specifically to section 7.5 of the agreement, and 7.5 clearly says it allows for remuneration on the conclusion of grievances. You've got that incorporated in the very provision that the other side is relying upon. There's no ambiguity in this case. And finally, my final point is this, and I referred to the November 22 letter, which is from Arbitrator Cox to Dave Perkins and to John Neighbors, counsel for the company. In the final paragraph on the first page, it reads, "Under my final award, to the extent stated, employees are to be made whole for any loss of earnings they suffered, as I have provided. While John made a proposal to resolve the back pay question during a November 5 conference call that I thought should be explored, my authority is limited, and any resolution of the alternative approach may have to be by mutual agreement." Moving on to the next paragraph, John had proposed that there be a change in the remedy, and that a make-whole remedy would require the assembly employees to be paid the differences between the earnings they would have received under a newly established rate as found appropriate by the arbitrator and what they actually paid. Such a remedy is clearly beyond the scope of my authority in this arbitration. I submit to you that what you have here is course of dealing. You have an interpretation of this contract, and that interpretation by the act of the parties demonstrates that make-whole remedy was apparently at some point prior to the filing of this lawsuit accepted by the company, as it should, given the language of the contract. Any questions? Thank you
very
much.
Thank you, Mr. Howell. Mr. Neighbors, your time had expired, but we'll give you a minute for rebuttal if you like.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll just comment on the last point because it is mistaken. We had the discussions. Mr. Hamilton was not a part of them, and what we were having were discussions to see if we could resolve an issue. It has been steadfastly our position that the arbitrator's authority was limited. But rather than come through this procedure and take up both the district court's time and this court's time in this procedure, we decided that it was appropriate to have settlement discussions. If you'll note at the end of the letter cited by Mr. Hamilton, he says at the second to last paragraph, it is entirely up to the parties to reach a mutual agreement if they're going to negotiate a rate to settle this matter. Those were settlement discussions that took place between the party, and the company never, ever conceded to the arbitrator's authority to impose a back pay remedy. In fact, has taken exception with it throughout, and it's noted in his first interim award where he says the issue is whether the standards were properly set. The only time back pay is mentioned in any of that decision was when he goes on and says the union requests back pay. The company has always resisted a back pay award. This was a settlement discussion that was taking place to try to avoid the inconvenience of this process on this court. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.